From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This is a piece of music called First Construction in Metal. It was written by John Cage, one of the most innovative American composers of the 20th century. His music still dazzles and challenges audiences. We'll explore his life and music today. And we'll try to answer the question, why will people exclaim over a Mark Rothko painting, but wince at the sound of experimental music? Also, we'll meet the young, spiky-haired piano phenom who's introducing classical music to new listeners, Lang Lang. But first, Wesley Stace, on his new novel, Charles Jessold, considered as a murderer.
24th of June, 1923. A double murder, followed by the suicide of the perpetrator, has taken place in a cul-de-sac off Kensington High Street. Jealousy is the principal motive for the crime. The police were summoned at 2 o'clock yesterday morning, when witnesses at Cadogan Mansions were startled by the report of a revolver. Constable Williams, forcing the door open, found the body of the composer Charles Jessold, aged 35 years, holding a blood-stained, five-chambered revolver, which he had discharged into his jaw. On the bed lay the bodies of his wife, mezzo-soprano Victoria London, and Edward Manville, a married man. The Jessold's two-month-old baby was found awake in his crib.
That's Wesley Stace reading the opening of his new novel, Charles Jessold, considered as a murderer. Novelist Stace leads a double life. He's also the singer-songwriter John Wesley Harding. His new novel is the first to be specifically about music. Stace told Anne Strainchamps about his inspiration for the book.
I saw a Werner Herzog documentary about Gesualdo, this composer in the Renaissance who murdered his wife and her lover. With a Herzog documentary, you can't tell how much is fact and fiction. I loved it. I immediately went and kind of tried to find out the facts, and they're extremely as startling as Herzog could have possibly made them up, you know. And I suddenly thought, I want to write a novel about that, but I didn't want to write a novel that was, you know, period novel to that time in history set in Italy. So I thought, oh, I'll have a modern composer. And these two ideas kind of artist-critic codependency and also an artist who murders his wife and her lover. Those two things became entwined for me.
So anyway, we've got this very promising beginning here. Adultery, a revenge killing, and a suicide, a famous composer, an aborted musical performance. It sounds like the stuff of melodrama.
Well, yeah, it is. I tried to structure the novel in a rather operatic way, so it has kind of acts. And what happens is Leslie Shepherd, my rather buttoned-up ideologue critic, tells the story to the police as it happened, and then he kind of revisits it from a more personal perspective. It's a classic novel structure to look at the same events from a different point of view. And the novel is called Charles Jessold, Considered as a Murderer. And the point is, if he were considered another way, would his art mean something different? And I think there's a way in which the novel, in a sense, is a critique of the kind of biographical approach to criticism, which I see in rock music writing a lot, where people say, oh, Bob Dylan had a heart attack, therefore his next album was all about death. You know, and you can tell that he had this heart attack. And it's like, all his albums are about death, you know, but that's a way that criticism works. And I think there are pitfalls in that. And so if you want to take a piece of art and use it as your text, you can approach that in a number of ways. And people's biographies and lives of the authors, the creators of it, can lead you up blind alleys and garden paths. And that's kind of what the book's about.
Mm-hmm.
Shepherd and Jessold, the critic and the composer, discover, as was completely normal at the time, a folk song in the field. It's a time when nations were just about to go to war and were rediscovering their own national music. It's a very rich time for English music, particularly because at the time, England's favourite composers were Wagner, Strauss, Mendelssohn, and Handel, you know, and they're all German. And England's just about to go to war with Germany, so England wants to find its own national music. And as many other nations had before it, the composers turned to the folk songs to find the kind of national heritage of melody. And that was the milieu that I chose to set this in, because it seemed a very rich time musically and culturally. And so it starts off with them finding this folk song. And the folk song is Little Musgrave, a song that I've recorded myself because I love it. And it's an incredible, great song, one of the greatest of the folk ballads.
So what is this ballad?
Now, a lot of ballads, what happens is they're rather mysterious, because one always seems to end up in the fifth act of them, as though everything's already happened and you come in at the climax. Little Musgrave is quite unique, and it's known to rock music fans as Matty Groves by Fairport Convention, which I believe is an American version of it. But it's quite unique in that you get the whole three or five act tragedy, as it were, and it's about Little Musgrave, a young man who gets the glad eye from Lady Barnard while her husband's off hunting, and the Lord is told, and he comes back. Well, I'm going to read it to you because I've written it down, and I've written it down so carefully that it seems a shame to be fumbling through. Here we go. To scholars, the ballad is known simply as Child 81, after its numerical designation in Francis James Child's monumental collection. The basic story has the tragic pull typical of the big ballad. The Lord is hunting, his lady seduces a young man, a page runs to alert the Lord, who returns to confront the lovers in bed. He slays them both. That is all. So slowly he rose up, and slowly he put on, and slowly down the stairs he goes, thinking to be slain. And the first stroke Little Musgrave took, it was both deep and sore, and down he fell at Barnard's feet, and word he never spoke more. And how do you like his cheeks, lady? Yeah, how do you like his chin? And how do you like his fair body? Now there's no life within. Oh, it's well I like his cheeks, she said, well I like his chin, better I like his fair body than all your kith and kin. And he's taken up his long, long sword to strike a mortal blow, and through the lady's heart, the cold steel it did go. As it fell out upon a day, as many in the year, Musgrave to the church did go to see fair ladies there.
Do you think you write like a composer in some ways?
You know, there's a very, very honourable tradition of fictional literary composers, you know, all the way from rather dull ones like Jean-Christophe by Romain Rolland, and then Adrian Levacoon in Thomas Mann, and Proust's composer Vinteuil, of course, who's central to that big, big book. And plenty of recent ones. David Mitchell just wrote about one. Ishiguro did one too. And I think what I learned from reading some of those books is that sometimes the composers just become symbols for the artist in the novelist's mind. And I wanted to make Jessel very specifically a composer that was a believable one and a recognisable one to me. And I know that a lot of artistic creation, as you do and lots of everybody else does, is haphazard and not as well planned as critics would have us believe, and that things turn on the slightest and most dubious is of arrival of the gentleman from Porlock or whatever it is, you know. So these odd things just feed into our what we do. So I'd say, in fact, that I really wanted him to be as believable a composer as I am a composer. And so a lot of the things that I go through when writing and creating, I kind of put on him, and I would hope that would make him realistic. I certainly did want to make him into a very fully fleshed out human being.
I'm curious what that means. If you're going to create a character who's a composer and you want him to be very realistic, what are the possible pitfalls, or what do you think are mistakes that other writers may have made in trying to create characters who were composers?
Well, I think some writers haven't described the music enough. I don't think you have to tell readers very much, but I think they want a very specific idea in their heads of what the artistic creations sound like. You couldn't write a movie, say, about a comedian and have none of his material in that movie. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you have to kind of write it in your head. And I did find myself, I mean, I'm no great music theorist, but I did find myself humming melodies that I found to be Jesoldian melodies. In fact, you know, my friend Daniel Felsenfeld, who's a composer in New York, he did me the great honor of taking on the mantle of kind of being Charles Jesold and setting one of these pieces of that Jesold set in the book to real music.
I wanted to ask you about that, because here is this song, five-song suite, in the style of Charles Jesold, which really makes him seem very real.
Yeah, to be totally clear, this is the music of Daniel Felsenfeld. It's not him writing what he just wrote the music as beautifully as he could. I just think I picked the right guy because I think the approach is how I imagine Jesold's might well have sounded.
One of the subjects that you take on in the novel is questions of musical taste and what happens when a new musical revolution, new style appears and how complicated its reception is, both from critics and from audiences. I was thinking about that tumultuous time in music history, the beginning of the avant-garde in music. That is still a form of music that audiences have a hard time accepting. I think perhaps people accept avant-garde painting more than they do avant-garde music.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I have no doubt at all that you're right. I mean, my Shepherd, it might be a tough bit to find in the book, but okay, here we go. This is Shepherd being taken by Jesold to hear Schoenberg, who Shepherd is bound to detest. Schoenberg's Austrian, but he speaks German, and that's bad news to begin with. And then there's the music, and he's listening to it. In the maelstrom, I glimpsed Schoenberg's intent. I understood the perverse aesthetic behind his intellectual conclusions. The poles of tonality and atonality were reversed. This was the triumph of theory over practice, abstraction over depiction, of cold intellectual thought over the urge to give pleasure. It was the end of music as I could possibly know or describe it. To see this progression towards atrocity dramatized before me was too much. The last movement was inhumane, even to the very performers in front of our eyes. It was the murder of the human song. Surprised when the quartet reached the final chord together, I found that I had been holding my breath, for how long I do not know, in anticipation. I gasped and inhaled in relief, unable to believe this was truly the end, vaguely disappointed with the final resolution on an F-sharp triad. Lasting but 10 minutes, the final movement had seemed an eternity.
Wesley Stace is the author of Charles Jesold, Considered as a Murderer. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. To hear more of that music we were talking about, you'll find a link on our website, ttbook.org. David Stubbs is the author of Fear of Music, Why People Get Rothko But Don't Get Stockhausen. In the book, Stubbs argues that avant-garde music doesn't get the same respect that avant-garde art enjoys. Stubbs got the idea for the book while he was watching, for what may have been the 12th time, the 1961 film The Rebel, starring the British comedian Tony Hancock.
He's kind of this aspiring artist, and he goes to Paris. He's actually rubbish, but also the kind of avant-garde there is sort of taken in by him. I think he's invented this wonderful new infantile school of art. But, in fact, he doesn't really know an awful lot himself. But it occurred to me that at one point he sees a piece of abstract expressionism on somebody's wall, and he sort of goes, blimey, who's gone raving mad ear then? And it occurred to me that the joke really wasn't actually on the piece of art. the joke was on him for not sort of appreciating that this qualifies as art. And this is like, you know, getting on, what, about 50 years ago. Already then, there was a kind of acceptance of contemporary abstract, non-figurative art as being valid. But still now, I find that, you know, the kind of precise sort of musical equivalent, be it Stockhausen or whatever, still completely confounds people, and they still consider it risible. They just think, you know, it's just silly plinky-plonky music. So, you know, people are sort of feel licensed to be Philistine about contemporary music in a way that they've long ceased to be about contemporary art.
So if somebody like the star of The Rebel were to make that comment about a piece of art, we'd all recognize it as a joke. But if they made it about a piece of avant-garde music, we would agree with them.
But yeah, this is it. I think, you know, for a lot of people, yes, the joke would be on the music, not on the idiot that made the remark.
Yeah. It's strange, isn't it? I mean, that modern art has somehow managed to achieve acceptance while music is ignored, because they were developed more or less the same time, weren't they? They were both born essentially in the 20s.
Yeah, and I think they both came from the sort of same sort of wellspring of kind of cultural energy, and at a certain time, the dawn of the 20th century. You know, there was a sort of synergy at the time, and people like Schoenberg, you know, Arnold Schoenberg, and Kandinsky, the painter, they almost like recognised each other as kindred spirits. Kandinsky looked at Schoenberg and think, well, yeah, that's what I'm doing in painting. And Schoenberg looked at Kandinsky and said, yes, and vice versa. That was how strong the kind of interconnection was. You know, things like futurism didn't just give rise to a kind of new dynamic way of looking at art, but also Luigi Russolo wrote the Art of Noises Manifesto, which is profoundly influential on development of 20th century music. So yes, initially there was this kind of very strong kind of interconnection between the two things.
Didn't Schoenberg and Kandinsky even promised to work with each other at one point?
They did. They were going to have some sort of synergized event.
Actually, I'm beginning to wonder whether we simply haven't listened enough to avant-garde music. The avant-garde art is sort of all around us, whereas avant-garde music is still restricted.
Yeah, it is marginal. I think abstract art is easier to consume. That's one thing. I mean, it's, say, a sort of difficult canvas by a Rothko. You go to, say, the Tate Modern and see something like that, or Museum of Modern Art in New York or whatever, and it's within your field of vision. You can spend as much or as little time in front of it as you please. It isn't kind of all enveloping. You know, you can spend 5 minutes in front of it, contemplate it, do whatever, you know, art is supposed to do to you, although I'm always kind of slightly doubtful about, you know, the idea that art has a kind of aura and emanates kind of elevating art rays that somehow make you a better human being. But that's perhaps another question. But anyway, you can spend just a few minutes in front of it. It's within your field of vision. Music, of course, it's not like that. The music, say a piece by Stockhausen, you might be there for 90 minutes. You're in for the long haul.
Right.
It's circumambient, you know.
Well, I was thinking about it and realizing that when I see a piece of art that I don't understand, I can look at it, close my eyes, think about it, look at it again, and go through that process several times until it begins to make some sense. You don't have that experience with avant-garde music because it is all around you. It's almost as though it interferes with your ability to think about it.
Yes, in a sense. I mean, you said it, you know, you can close your eyes. Of course, you have eyelids and you don't have earlids. And
right.
Yes. Music, you know, has that kind of possibility of being distressing and invasive, especially people like Stockhausen. Sometimes he would arrange the speakers for sort of pieces that he did. It wouldn't just be something that was just in front of you, coming at you in front of you. He would arrange it all around the auditorium. So the music is coming at you from all sides. And it may be that goes back to kind of very early sort of caveman days or whatever, where any sort of sudden noise, unexpected noise, is going to sort of strike fear into you. And I think that probably is still the case for people now. And of course, music can sometimes have that distressing, invasive effect, and especially avant-garde music, because it's inherently informally, it's meant to be kind of surprising, unexpected, coming at you from somewhere unexpected.
But I want to go back to those early days in some ways, because both mediums were new. The painting was new, the music was new, and there was a fuller range than I think we recognize now. You talked a little bit about the futurist movement, the futurist painter Luigi Russolo, and Frank Zappa, and everybody knows Zappa, but there was also Edgar Reyes, who wrote Amérique, the sort of classic work, which is not as disturbing, if you will, as Stockhausen or as Schoenberg. It's new and it's different and it challenges you, but it is not as random, I guess.
Well, that's right. I mean, that work, Amérique, it was written, it was about 1918, that sort of time, 1918, 1921. I think he sort of spent some time over it and then eventually revised it. Within that piece, you get a sense of the transition of music from the 19th to 20th century almost, because it starts off in a very sort of Debussy-esque, Stravinsky-esque sort of way, in the sort of dawn of the piece, as it were. But then all of a sudden, you know, the music suddenly erupts with these kind of very vertical crescendos, very American, very New York, almost like skyscrapers kind of emerging music, whatever. That sense of kind of new urban contemporary 20th century beginnings, and it really reflects a sense of America in a way that classical music really hadn't done at all before, not even really people like Charles Ives as such. But of course the big thing we've got is the sirens. You get these kind of sirens wailing through, and obviously they're kind of, you know, he had his window open in his apartment near the Hudson River as he was writing it, and these sounds would come wafting in through his window. And there's, so there's a couple of things going on there. One, it's the idea of, like, which I think is at the heart of the avant-garde project, as far as I'm concerned. It's collapsing the walls between art and life. You're getting the actual elements of life incorporated into the music in the way that Picasso incorporates, like, sort of clippings of Le Figaro into collage pieces and stuff like that. And then also you've got the idea of the pitch, this pitch that incorporates the element of noise into music, something way beyond the whole sort of 12-tone system, etc., etc., which is something that I think that we talked about earlier, Luigi Russolo, he initiated that idea in his Art of Noises manifesto, the idea of admitting noise as an element within music.
Do you think people would find it more approachable if they could think about it in visual terms?
Possibly. It's curious. I think that people accept a great deal more visual chaos than they do oral chaos. I think a lot of contemporary music does sometimes try and give it, you know, use sort of digital imagery or whatever to give it a kind of a visual component. And I think that can work, and I think that's one of the ways in which they've attempted to kind of synergize, certainly in the late 20th century, 21st century. So that could be a form of assistance. But another reason I think people have problems with avant-garde music is that they think it's like a kind of cryptic crossword or something like that. They think that they have to decipher something. And you actually don't. It's not like some sort of complex mathematical or algebraic formula rendered in sound. It's simply a case of being receptive to the idea of sounds not becoming, you know, sort of following the kind of normal orthodox pathways or whatever. It's really not necessarily about having to kind of interpret anything.
You don't have to figure it out. You just have to accept that it's not what you're accustomed to hearing.
Yeah, just accept it as it, yeah, what it is, yeah.
Brings us to Stockhausen, because Varèse is a little easier, a little more familiar, if you will. Even though it does structure itself in ways that are completely unexpected, it still sounds, at least at the beginning, that our sounds were accustomed to. Stockhausen really made his breakthroughs in electronic music, and that's not music that we knew much about at the time that it began to stake its claim on the world. One of his most famous works is called Kontakte.
Kontakte, yes.
Kontakte. Can you tell us about that?
Which means contacts. Well, yes, it was written about 50 years ago. He arranged it so that, like, the audience is in the centre and the music comes to them via four channels, which are arranged like in speakers, were in each kind of corner of the sort of square within which the audience is sitting. And even at one point, he uses some sort of rotation table at one point, so he had all these various mics in which he could kind of, like, fling even other sounds at the audience as they kind of listen to it. So it goes back to what I was saying before. It's the idea of there isn't any kind of preset sort of pathway or whatever. You know, the way it's constructed allows for sounds to come from absolutely any angle, take any kind of sort of shape or duration or pitch or intensity or whatever. It's opening up music completely. I mean, in fact, Stockhausen, I think he functions as a composer sort of better than, say, other people working in electronic music or music concrete, because I think he has a kind of innate sort of symphonic sense, a great innate sense of drama. So it isn't like he's just sort of flinging sounds at you randomly. Obviously, it's extremely conceptually, it's extremely kind of, well, kind of constructed, but I think he actually has a almost like a conventional, you know, sense of musical drama. I think the reason that people fixate on art by contrast, and why something like the Tate Modern is so hugely possible. I mean, there's various reasons, but one of them, I think, is the idea of the aura of the original. And there isn't really an equivalent for the original in music. You've got maybe a master tape, you've got a sheet on which something was composed, whatever, but there isn't the original. It's, you know, essentially it's about reproduction or replication through performance, whatever. So that's missing. And of course, the original in art obviously has tremendous economic value. You know, at least, say, constant reading about canvases, you know, like Bacon or whatever, you know, selling for 30, 40, 50 million pounds. And so people go goggle-eyed at those kind of figures. And obviously, with each news story, you know, comes a little picture of the sort of work of art in question. People become exposed to that. So on the one hand, there's the tremendous financial value attached to modern art. And I think there is also this kind of auratic element, you know, the idea that these tremendously valuable, precious pieces, if you stand near them, as I was saying earlier on, somehow art rays will emanate from them and somehow inspire you or elevate you in some way. It's difficult for music certainly to match this thing of the original, and I think that's certainly why music lags behind in terms of its public profile, or contemporary music certainly.
David Stubbs is the author of Fear of Music, Why People Get Rothko But Don't Get Stockhausen. Do you agree that people are more appreciative of experimental art than experimental music? Tell us what you think. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, a look at the life and music of the brilliant composer John Cage. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
John Cage was a brilliant composer who wrote some of the most controversial music of the 20th century. There's the famous composition called 4 Minutes 33 Seconds, in which not a single note is played. There's a 5-hour multimedia extravaganza featuring 7 harpsichords, 52 tapes of computer-generated sounds, and 64 slide projectors. Writer Kenneth Silverman explores John Cage's life and music in a groundbreaking new biography called Begin Again. As Silverman told Steve Paulson, a lot of Cage's creativity came from his father, the inventor, John Milton Cage, Sr.
You know, when Cage was studying with Arnold Schoenberg in California, Schoenberg said about Cage, he said, he's not a composer, he's an inventor of genius. As Cage recognized, there's a lot of his father's inventiveness in Cage.
Mm-hmm. Now, from a very early age, Cage was drawn to new ways of thinking about art, what we might call the avant-garde. What was he reacting against?
Well, at different times, he was reacting against different things. Early on, like a lot of other people, he was reacting against romanticism, you know, this kind of emotionality in the arts, in poetry, composing, and so on. That was not at all, of course, a novel thing at the time that Cage started out. You know, people like T.S. Eliot and James Joyce, they were all reacting against romantic writing. I think Eliot said, Joyce, I guess it was, said, you know, the writer is in the wings just watching the action. Eliot insisted on impersonality. The writing isn't about you, it's about something else. You don't use your writing to express your personality. Cage entirely took that over and felt that music should, you know, contra Beethoven, whom he called a toilet paper. Contra Beethoven, music does not express emotion. It expresses sound.
So maybe it wasn't surprising then that he gravitated in his 20s to the modern composer Schoenberg. In fact, he studied with Schoenberg.
He did study with Schoenberg in California, got to know him pretty well. Schoenberg had had him personally over to his house. It was a couple of times he chauffeured Schoenberg and his wife around in a car. The thing that Schoenberg really taught him, he decided, was discipline. Composing is hard work, disciplined work. You don't get around.
Hmm. So how did this figure into Cage's own life, this life of discipline?
Well, he's the hardest working person I've ever known anything about. He worked morning, noon, and night constantly. I mean, just I've never known anyone to work that way. Also, the kind of composing he did required not just very intense concentration and very, very, very minute work. It's hard to imagine anyone, hard for me to imagine anyone devoting that much time so intensely to such minute work, really.
Now, we should talk some about John Cage's innovations. For instance, he came up with something called the prepared piano.
Henry Cowell, the composer, who was a good friend of Cage, someone Cage respected very much, had once put some kind of metal pan on top of the keys of a piano to get a sort of tittering effect. And I think he also plucked a string with a needle point or something like that. Cage heard that and was very influenced by it and took it, you know, about 20 steps further by inserting various objects between the strings of the piano, a rubber eraser or a screw, endless kinds of items, which entirely changed the timbre of the piano and gave it a kind of percussive quality. I mean, he made the piano sound like a new instrument, which it really became. And what he said about it was that now someone sitting at the piano can be a whole percussion orchestra, just producing all these percussive sounds together. This is quite wonderful, all those early prepared piano pieces. He certainly did not want his reputation to rest on that. And I mean, he worked with a prepared piano maybe a half dozen years, something like that, and then really gave it up. Hmm.
So did he find the conventional piano too limiting?
I think it isn't that so much as Cage's audiophilia. Cage loved sound. That's the basic thing, it seems to me, about Cage. He loved sound. I mean, in a way that I don't know anyone else who does. In European American music, the range of sounds is actually extremely limited. I mean, the world is full of sound. And Cage wanted to bring new sound into music. It's ridiculous to think that music can be organized only by, you know, the scale, the European classical scale, A, B, C, D, F, G. He wanted to bring all kinds of new sounds into music.
Well, and it seems that maybe there wasn't such a clear distinction in his mind between what was music and what was sound, and because virtually anything that we experience in the world, anything that we can hear, could conceivably be worked into a musical composition.
That's true, except the distinction for him simply was that music was what he called organized sound. It's not just, just sound. It's, as he calls it, organized sound. And he found various ways, you know, of organizing all kinds of new sounds, sounds that really no one had ever listened to.
Hmm. Like what kinds of sounds that people hadn't heard before?
The needle of a cactus being plucked.
Wow.
That's one of his sounds. He wanted to really get the sounds of mushroom spores dropping, all kinds of sounds in Cage. One of the most beautiful expressions of that, I think, is his pieces for what he called ambient sound, what it sounds like to be, let's say, in Madison or in New York, what's in the air. Cage, in one case, he went to Ireland, and he recorded all over Ireland, you know, just different sounds that he heard here and there and there and there, and organized them all together in this wonderful Irish piece called Roratorio. It's just wonderful to listen to. I mean, to me, it's just delightful. You've never heard this stuff before.
Is that the nocturne? What you got? The fall.
And he also had a philosophy about how to put this together, and probably various strands of philosophy. For instance, he was, in the early 50s, very drawn to notions of chance, and particularly stemming from the classic Chinese text, the I Ching. Can you tell me about that?
Well, that's right. Cage was very interested in Oriental thinking and Oriental music. For a while, he studied Buddhism at Columbia University with the famous Zen teacher, Daisetsu Suzuki, who became a close friend of Cage's. As a way of organizing sound, also, he relied on a book called the I Ching, which is a 3,000-year-old book of Chinese divinations. You roll some coins or something, and that leads you to a hexagram, so-called, in the I Ching, which has a message for you, which supposedly is the answer to the question you're raising. And Cage used the I Ching, you know, sort of impersonally, rolling things, get to this ideogram, get to that ideogram, and start putting together ideas from these ideograms. So not just one or two, but hundreds, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them put together for a piece. That is, he wanted to keep himself out of it. You know, that was the impersonal thing.
Why did he want to keep himself out of it?
It's a good question. I mean, you would ask also, why did T.S. Eliot want to keep himself out of it, or why did James Joyce want to keep himself out of it? I think they just thought so much of 19th century romantic writing was just schmaltzy, you know? It was a pain to hear about this, all this one's wounds and yelps and cries and I'm sorry. You know, it was too much. The 20th century wasn't like that. It was an industrial time. It was hard-edged. And there was the war. We heard enough about suffering and everything, sort of wanted to get away from it.
Now, between 1952 and 1953, John Cage pursued a huge project that he called the Williams Mix. What was this?
Yes. Oh, unbelievably complicated tape piece that he worked on together with Earl Brown, another composer. They sat splicing tape. The chance directions told him, you know, how large a slice of tape to use.
Which is very hard to do for anyone who's actually worked with tape. I mean, to manipulate that physical material and to, you know, not lose it.
Well, they worked just absolutely day and night. I mean, really, really, really day and night on it. I mean, smoking old butts. He and Earl Brown sat across from each other on a table with these loops of tape and hundreds of envelopes. The envelopes had different notes and different subjects in them, and the I Ching told them which note to go to, which subject to go to. It's all put together by chance, and these little micro tapes, and you put them all together, really sounds quite wonderful. You've just never heard anything like this before.
And you suggest in your book that the difficulty itself was part of the appeal for John Cage.
Oh, no question. I've never known anyone with such an appetite for complexity. Yeah, absolutely. He loved swimming in the most intense difficulty. They had a kind of social content, too. He also wrote a set of violin pieces that he said were unplayable. I mean, they're so incredibly complex, and nobody could ever play them. In fact, they have been played, and they're very, very wonderful. But one of his thoughts there was that if he could show that the unplayable was really playable, maybe we could achieve something like peace, you know? People think there can't be peace. Maybe people can really do the impossible, was really his point. I must say, you know, after working with Cage, he really taught me how to listen to music, which I had never done. Now I listen. I'm very careful. I'm listening hard to what it is that I'm hearing, and I hear all kinds of things I had never heard before that if I were just sitting back and hearing it. You know, that's the point of his famous 4:33, this famous silent piece that he wrote, 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. You know, he had it divided into three movements, I guess, and the pianist would sit silently at a piano with the keyboard open, close it after the first movement, the keyboard after the first one. Then he would open it, you'd have the second movement, nothing, playing nothing, close it after the second movement, sit there, open it, and play the third movement. Cage's point, of course, was that there was no silence there at all. The atmosphere was filled with sound. People were just not listening. For Cage, there was no avoiding sound. Everything has sound. Everything has sound.
Hmm. Now, this has become an iconic piece, 4:33, but it wasn't that well received at first, was it? I mean, when it was performed as a premiere in 1952 in Woodstock, New York?
Well, I guess not. I mean, it's always been made a lot of fun of, and in fact, it's been made much, much, much too much of. People should listen to Cage's, whatever, his concert for piano and orchestra, and instead of, they should talk about that instead of talking about 4:33. It was a little thing, just a little lesson that he was making, but of course it stuck and it got a lot of publicity.
Supposedly, I mean, legend has it that someone in the audience afterwards said, you know, we should run these people out of town.
I think so, yes. Very good. Okay. It's hard to say that about any other American composer, I think.
Yeah. You know, what I find fascinating about thinking about Cage's work is that he celebrated chance. He celebrated sort of just things happening the way they might in the real world, and yet he was meticulous about the way he organized things. For instance, he didn't just want someone to perform one of his pieces and just do whatever they wanted with it. I mean, this was not the anything goes aesthetic. It was quite the opposite.
Oh, it was exactly the opposite. I mean, as I said, what he said he learned from Arnold Schoenberg was discipline. He expected people to take the music very seriously, no matter how complex the violin sonatas were. He expected the performer to absolutely respect the score and play everything exactly right.
At the end of your book, you write that Marcel Duchamp's widow, Tini Duchamp, described John Cage's sensibility in 5 words. He loved everything and nothing.
Yeah, that's good.
Does that sum up Cage's sensibility?
Yes, I think so. What I mean simply is that for his terrible passion and dedication and intense work, the way he worked, and then he gets a new idea, he gives up the earlier idea entirely and starts off on something entirely new, doesn't return to the other thing at all. Deeply in love, drops it, goes on to something else, deeply, deeply in love with it, forget it. Next thing.
Kenneth Silverman is the author of Begin Again, a biography of John Cage. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And this is John Cage's Concert for Piano and Orchestra. What do you think of John Cage's music? You can let us know by sending email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, we'll meet the young man that the New York Times calls the hottest artist on the classical music planet, Lang Lang, as we conclude our Hour on New Music. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Although he's only 28, Lang Lang has already accomplished a lot. He is the first Chinese pianist to be engaged by the Vienna Philharmonic, Berlin Philharmonic, and all of the top American orchestras. In 2009, he made Time magazine's annual list of the 100 most influential people in the world, and he's already written an autobiography, Journey of 1,000 Miles. Lang Lang's latest album, Live in Vienna, features his first recordings of Beethoven's sonatas, including the famous Appassionata. He sat down recently to talk with Steve Paulson.
You have some wonderful comments in the liner notes to the album saying that there's mystery behind the notes, kind of like Shakespeare's Hamlet. There's hidden passion underneath. Can you explain that?
Yeah. For example, you know, the first phrase of the sonata. It's really the first theme from Hamlet. Very simple. Who's there? You know, and that, for me, somehow is so connected to this piece. And also, you know, as you know, Shakespeare, all his play is like a conversation, right, between different characters. Mm-hmm. Unlike, you know, many of the novels, you just keep reading it. And this is more like it's a real play, you know, drama play.
Hmm.
And Beethoven's music is also, particularly on this piece, it's not a novel, but it's a script. Each phrase is, you know, interpreted by different characters. And you have this incredible breaks in between, and dynamic lines, and always some searching for kind of answers, but you never really find answers, but you try to really find out what's really under the ground, what's really there, you know. It's just whole curiosity and mysteries throughout the whole piece.
Hmm.
And also the explosion, you know, emotional explosion, and it goes out, its most warmest melody comes out, most striking rhythm on the groups of 16th note, and shocking contrast between the lowest point of the element and to the highest points, you know, within one bar, let's say.
Hmm. As a pianist, does Beethoven present any special challenges that you don't get from other composers?
Yes. First of all, his technique is quite unique in a way. He uses a lot of symphonic technique into pianistic playing. And as you know, many composers later, when you play their work, it's very comfortable. Even though, like, you know, Rachmaninoff is a very difficult composer to play, but it's very comfortable as a pianist. For Beethoven, even though, you know, sometimes the work sounds not that difficult, but it's so difficult to get the sound right, because he really make piano another orchestral instrument. The technique has such a diverse, you always need to search for the new skills to produce the sound in your mind.
Hmm. Now, I'm curious about what it's like for you to get up on stage in one of these truly grand occasions. I mean, I guess the obvious example would be the Olympics in Beijing, your home country, where the whole world was watching, especially your country, and so much was riding on that. Did you get nervous before you were playing?
I got nervous for the first rehearsal. I was really nervous. Not nervous, but overwhelmed, because when you walk out to the stadium, I mean, it's like 100,000 people there. We had like
100,000 people at, you mean at the dress rehearsal? There were that
many
people?
Yeah, at the dress rehearsal, we had 100,000 already, you know, to experience it. And at the same time, we had like 5,000 dancers around the piano. Oh my God, that was, you know, I was like playing, I didn't realize that the light is like turned on. You know, I mean, like all those dancers had a light on their, kind of like LED light on their clothes or outfits. When they turned it on, they're, I was like scared. It's like, oh my God, what's that?
Did it affect your playing at all? I mean, did it sort of get into your head?
No, it was okay. And I remember, you know, in the end, I think it was like 10 dancers or 15 dancers moved the piano off the stage, and then we just ran. And then, you know, that was really fun. But everybody thought we disappeared. But we didn't disappear. We were like running like hell.
Thank you.
Well, I want to take you back even a little bit earlier, because you tell some heartbreaking stories in your autobiography. I mean, you wrote about how you were under just tremendous pressure to succeed from your teachers and especially from your father. And you tell a really chilling story about how when you were 9 years old, you were having trouble getting ready for one audition. And at one point, apparently, your father got so upset that he ordered you to commit suicide. He even told you to jump off the balcony or swallow a whole bottle of pills, which, of course, you refused to do. And then you started punching the wall so hard that your hand started to bleed. How do you look back on that history? I mean, that probably was pretty formative about how you became a pianist.
This is a really tragic moment, you know, in my life. It's really hurt, you know, for a long time for me, you know, as a kid, because I always thought that being a pianist is the most beautiful thing in the world. And, you know, sometimes you have things happen, you know, you get fired by your teacher, your teacher saying that you're no talent, you shouldn't do this, you know, it's kind of, my dream kind of like get destroyed, like in a second, you know. And of course, you know, my father was also went nuts, you know. So that was really, really tragic, I would say, you know. That shouldn't happen in our music world. Mm-hmm. But in the same time, you know, it made me a stronger person.
Did that kind of pressure make you a better piano player?
No, because, I mean, for a long time, I didn't want to play. So it really didn't help, you know. Because I was really kind of disappointed to become a pianist, and I start hating piano. You know, it's like once you get pushed too hard, and then you start to hate it. You know what I mean? So that's not good. That's absolutely not good. But then finally, you know, I start loving piano again, and I find it's not piano's fault. You know, it's not because of piano. I mean, because, you know, that moment I really felt everything. It's because of I'm playing piano, so that's why every bad things happens. You know, I kind of thought about it for a long time. But then in the end, I'm like, you know, that's my childhood dream. I should achieve it. I shouldn't stop playing or start to hating piano because I had a bad time. You know, I think we need to overcome the challenge and to keep playing. So then, you know, made me a much stronger person and restart again.
Lang Lang spoke with Steve Paulson. Lang Lang's latest album is Live in Vienna. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 220A, New Music. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer Aubrey Ralph. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.